fish number 10496, reel 3.
Yep.
Air Vice Marshal Stewart, reel 3.
We had a rather curious situation at this time. The radar for controlling the aircraft giving cover over the beaches in front of the Americans was in fact a British radar with a British crew. And so there was a liaison with the Americans on that account, 8th Air Force. But not on a day-to-day basis.
How did your work and plans work out in practice when the big day came? Did it go smoothly, or were there unforeseen problems that came up?
Yes. I think you can say that they went as planned. As I remember it, most of the links of communication worked, and certainly the air to ground worked, and the radar worked as on the British side. On the American side, it didn't. For the very good reason that the poor beggars were all shot up on the way in. They were landed in too deep water. They went up onto a beach which I believe was under point blank fire from 88 millimeter German guns. And they had very heavy casualties, and the equipment was largely destroyed. And so that it was not good on that side. I suppose you could say that the situation was saved to some extent by the fact that the beaches were not really attacked by the German Air Force. So our aircraft did not have a very onerous defensive role to play. If we had, it would have been more awkward to have lost half our ground radar initial establishment.
So there were no special lessons to be learned after the event had occurred?
Well, of a kind, yes. We had, to some extent, anticipated the event. There were, in this country, less complex ground radar stations, and being less complex, capable of being broken down into lesser packages, and could have been transported very quickly. I, who by this time was Chief Signal Officer of 85 Group, which was the night fighting group, which was the one that wanted the radar help and the ground cover and so on, tried to activate this. We did, in fact, make a convoy. We put one of these backup setups on the road, drove down to Portsmouth, and tried to get across the channel with them. But the Navy, for reasons which I'm sure were professionally sound for them, didn't treat crossing the channel as a thing to be undertaken lightly. It was a big business, and we had to go in convoy and so on. By the time it was all this materialized, about 36 hours later, the point had gone. The other things had been done. And we unloaded and brought it back. So I think one would have to look much more closely at the backup, the arrangements for backup.
I think that you'd visited the USA in late 1943.
Yeah.
Was that in connection with the preparations for overworld?
In a sense, yes. I was told I was to go, and by my then boss, Porter, and I said, "What for?" And he said, "Oh, something rather vague, you know, but you'll be told." Time went on, got near and near the date. I still didn't know what I was going for, and I went up to see the Director General of Signals of the day, a remarkable chap called Sir Victor Tait, who had his 92nd birthday the other day, I think it was. And I said, "What am I going for?" And he said, "Oh, I'll just go and talk to these chaps about signals for tactical air forces." And with that brief and nothing in writing of any kind, I paddled off to America and went to the mission and found out the sort of local setup, got myself to the presence of the, I suppose you would call him the American equivalent to our Director General of Signals, and he gave me an office and permission to talk to anybody I liked, and that's what I did for several weeks. The Americans were attempting to build up about 6 tactical air forces at the same time, and it wasn't nearly as easy for them as both they and we might have thought. They were against all sort of accepted knowledge, were often just as short of equipment as we were, and were subject to the same sort of delays by manufacturers as we were, and it was not possible for them to do this job of building up these 6 things. And I paddled about a bit and filled my time in one way or another, and I thought about time I went home and sat down, wrote a report saying what I'd done, but the gist of which was I hope they will bring down their efforts to something much more practical, because I don't think they can do it. And showed it to the American director, and he didn't object, and then got myself a berth in Queen Elizabeth and went home. And quite a little while later I got a nice little chit from Vic Tate saying, "You will be glad to know that the Americans are not going to build 6 air force," or whatever it was, you know, they reduced their target.
Did you find when you visited America that their attitude towards the war was much different from ours?
Yeah, well, in a way, they're awfully innocent sort of guys. I remember I had pretty free hand. I could go more or less where I liked, within reason. And I elected to attend a conference where they were talking about how one would set about invading France. And a lot of thought had gone into that in this country by then. They were at square one. And I remember they were going to operate from here.
From where?
Devonshire. I suppose because Devonshire sticks down a little bit, you know. And this was all their operational planning was being talked about, and as an exercise, just an exercise. And I couldn't help myself from butting in on this and recounting the sort of sums that I'd heard done many times in this country of of the number of aircraft it takes to keep one aircraft over the ground at that end when you're 110 or 20 miles away, you know, and endurance comes into it and all the rest of it. And so I recounted a bit, and nobody actually slung me out of the room or kicked me or anything. I don't know that it made any impression.
Why were so many aircraft needed to keep one in the air?
Well, it's mostly endurance. You see, you've got a fighter, generally speaking, only stays in the air for an hour and a half or something like this. And so if it takes you half an hour to get there and half an hour to get back, you've only got half an hour useful patrol time. There are probably two aircraft crossing the channel on the way out all the time, and two coming back all the time, and this adds to the prodigious number you need to support the one guy who's out in front there on the job doing useful work.
Partly because of slow aircraft speeds in those
days. You were talking then of Spitz and similar, which cruised, I suppose, at 250 or something like this.
And why were your eyebrows raised when you heard it was Devonshire that they were thinking about?
Well, because they were choosing the widest possible piece of the channel, you see, where half the flying time would be wasted flying time, just getting there and back again.
So better if they'd have chosen the Southampton area?
Yes, and they were talking about beaches down at the Brittany area, you see, instead of the relatively short passage which we chose, or the even shorter passage which they might have looked at the Pas de Calais.
Who held this conference? Who
organized it? It was a fighter outfit, I don't remember. It was in the Pentagon, you know. In the Pentagon. That was where my base was most of the time. But it was great fun. It gave me a great love of America, and I was eventually posted there after the war, well after it. And we go over regularly now to see friends.
When the war finished, how did the signal situation for the RAF compare with how it had been at the beginning of the war? Presumably it was vastly different, was it?
Well, enormous technical advances, not only on the communications side, but in other commands, like Bomber Command, which I only know at second hand. Their navigation devices had changed out of this world. Coastal Command were able to use radar to catch submarines, H2S. Fighter Command, the air interception radar, the night fighter radar, had improved its range and reliability, had improved out of all knowledge in those two or three years after things got cracking, you know.
You weren't working for Bomber Command yourself during the war.
No.
How did the section of the Air Force in which you were working regard Bomber Command and the effort it was making with the air offensive against Nazi Germany? Did you support it, or did you resent the resources that were going into it?
I would be astonished if there was any resentment. I have no recollection of any such sentiment being expressed. They were doing a different job, which was quite different to the fighter job, and doing it, as far as we knew, damn well. At one point, we actually got involved. When the first 1,000 bomber raid was put on, they were short of a few sizable airplanes, and they took a few out of Army Cooperation Command to do it. That was my only semi-direct connection with performance at all.
But how did that go down?
The thousand bomber?
How did the fact that you helped them out with plans go down?
Oh, just perfectly normal. Nobody would think it particularly remarkable, you know. There was tremendous goodwill, and we all had this incredibly crystal clear aim of beat the hell out of the enemy, you know. Everybody had this. There was no doubt about the aim, about it. This is what we're losing, what we're missing nowadays. Nobody has got a single worthy aim. You know.
So it created a sense of unity within the RAF?
Oh, yes. Yes, very much so.
And do you think that that submerged the more petty rivalries?
Yes, I don't think there was any real rivalry. The great men may have, by that I mean the C's and C, they fought their corner to get resources, I've no doubt at all. But it would be, I think, in the long run, would be in a reasonable spirit. I think there was much more rivalry between services than within the service.
Did you see anything of inter-service rivalry?
I couldn't quote you anything, no. Going back to the point that I made earlier on, that the RAF provided the ground end of communications with the air in Army cooperation work. This was done on an extraordinary theory that only an airman could talk to an airman. The idea that an airman might talk to a soldier and vice versa was almost heresy. But there was a thing in 1937 or so called the Armoured Division. And the chief signal officer of that, a chap called Strait, and I thought, why don't we let the tank talk straight to the aeroplane and vice versa? And I think that was the beginning of direct communication between the two services. And it developed a great deal before the end of the war, and people thought nothing of it.
How did this chap spell his name?
Straight. He was a colonel then. I saw him later as a brigadier, and I'd be surprised if he didn't make general before he retired.
Did you come across any opposition to your proposal?
Nobody knew about them, I think. It was our private business, which we used to run. And as I said, AC, Army Corporation, was a sort of Cinderella thing, although we were in Fighter Command. I can't imagine anybody at Fighter Command at that time being very interested at all. They were much more interested in shooting down the aerial combat. You know.
I know that in Burma, with the Chindits, they always very often had an RAF officer on the ground.
Yes,
with them.
Yes.
Or ground-to-air communication.
Yes. I think he was there, not quite the same. He was there as a technical advisor, I think, telling them what was possible and what wasn't. And also, I think he was talking to pilots, wasn't he?
Yes.
He would need to know the language, as it were, which a non-practicing pilot might not really understand. It isn't quite the same as just pure communications. It would be done for the reason of technical liaison, the technical meaning operational. What the pilot, he knew what was possible to the guys in the air. And would avoid asking for the impossible.
And also it would give pilots some experience of what it was like on the ground.
Yes.
With the results of their bombing.
Very uncomfortable, actually.